So for the past few months, if you follow me on Instagram, you know this, and that's really the only social media I do at all now, then you know that I have been slowly teasing, prepping for another Leonardo DiCaprio retrospective. I did one a couple of years ago to coincide with the release of Don't Look Up, and it's one of my favorite episodes I've ever done. It made me really emotional. If you listen to this podcast or if you know me at all, you know that Leo's work has meant a lot to me over, I guess, 26 years now. And of course, it started with Titanic. I'd never deny that. But the thing is, if you follow Leo's career, you know that there has never been another Titanic. He's never done another quote-unquote heartthrob movie. He's never done another true love story. And that's probably purposeful on his part. How would I get into his brain? I've never met him. Maybe one day. But what he has done is very purposely chosen movies that deal with confronting a historical event or confronting how we view a historical figure, or in recent years, confronting issues that stand right before us in our society and culture and history, turning points, you know, climate change with Don't Look Up, which, do not listen to the critics that got scared by that film. It is scary, but it's an incredible movie. And now with Killers of the Flower Moon. And so I wanted to revisit a few of the films of his that I hadn't for the retrospective a couple of years ago. Films like Total Eclipse, which I had to order a DVD copy of off of eBay, because it's not in print anymore. It's not on streaming anywhere, and it may be lost to time. It's the film where he plays the young French author and poet, or young poet, Arthur Rimbaud. And when I was a teenager, I used to carry around a book of Rimbaud poems. But I don't feel like the original intent for this episode works anymore. And that's because I did see Killers of the Flower Moon twice this past weekend. Directed by Martin Scorsese, it is an adaptation of David Grand's book Killers of the Flower Moon from 2017, in which he meticulously researched and then wrote the story of the Reign of Terror, the murder of American Indians, of Osage Indians in Oklahoma in the early part of the 20th century, and the investigation by the early FBI to solve these crimes. And after seeing the movie, there's not really anything else I can talk about but that movie. And of course, Leo's performance, unshockingly, is heartbreaking, brutal, interesting, because he plays a villain, very bad person in all of this. So today, I bring you not a retrospective, but a review of Killers of the Flower Moon, a review of the book Killers of the Flower Moon, a discussion about it and some of the press reporting on it, a few Leo thoughts. But really, the most important thing is, please go see this movie. I say all the time on this podcast that American history is not the pretty picture that you get in eighth grade in your U.S. history class here in America. It's the furthest thing from it. And this book, this movie, does the hard work of showing the dirty, chaotic, brutal nature that can be American history. So most important thing is, I don't know, if you turn this off right now and go see the movie, that's fine. Or come back after the theme music and hear a little bit more about this important moment in film, this important moment in Leo's career, and how this has inspired me to think even more about some of my projects in American history. I'm Ellie Beatles, and this is Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast. Please join me for a discussion about Leonardo DiCaprio's astounding new film, Martin Scorsese's astounding new film, Lily Gladstone's astounding new film. She's incredible, and you should know her name, Killers of the Flower Moon. A couple of housekeeping items, as they say. I am, of course, so grateful for all of my Patreon members. If you have recently joined, you will be thanked on a regular episode very soon. This is categorized as kind of a special episode, these are. Thank you, all my Patreon members, for allowing me to keep this podcast going. I am not going to lie. It's a lot of work. It's fun. It's turned into, honestly, some weeks an almost full-time job when you count in research, recording, editing, email correspondence, social media management. I'm trying to grow the podcast. And you are the foundation, Patreon members. I think it's amazing that that platform exists because I've said it before and I'll say it again. The reason I don't advertise anything but other independent podcasts is because I believe in some amount of ethics in advertising, and a lot of podcasts, and even some of my favorite ones, to be honest, use the middleman ad services where they just sign a contract and they have a gap in their recording and they sell that gap. And the middleman service can put any ad they want in that gap, and it could end up being underwear, or it could end up being something political that you don't even agree with, or it could end up being something just really ridiculous. And so I don't want to do that. I am happy to advertise other independent podcasts that I think are quality, and definitely looking into potential advertising opportunities with Titanic-related places and products because I support those. But yeah, I don't want to throw the shaving apparatus ad on this podcast. I'm not going to do it. That's why Patreon matters so much. And I know I mention it a lot, and there are probably listeners out there that are thinking to themselves, oh my gosh, she's asking us for money. And yeah, I guess that's what it is. But I believe in honesty and transparency and ethics in all of this. So yes, Patreon is very important to keeping this podcast going. If you are a longtime listener and you've thought about it, go for it if you can, if you're able. There are tiers that are just $1 a month, $3 a month, all the way up to the larger tiers with bigger perks. But that's my pitch for today. Thank you to my Patreon members. A couple of exciting things. Mugs are coming. I have two designs by listeners, people that I didn't commission these. These are just amazing Titaniac listeners that approached me with their artwork and were kind enough to say, hey, I've been working on this. What do you think? And my reaction was, wow, this is beautiful, because they're both beautiful. And can I put them on mugs? And can we sell these to Titaniacs? And the cool thing is that I want to support independent artists. So it's going to be a 50-50 split on all profits. And I'll also be giving a small portion of my profits to World Central Kitchen. So those are coming. One is of the Titanic crew, and it's illustration. And the other is Bruce Ismay related. It very much continues to astound me how much people are obsessed with his story. I think it's just indicative of how much we see ourselves in the Titanic story, ethically, morally. You know, every guest I've ever had on a book club episode has said the same thing about why Titanic? Why do we keep going back to it? Why do we keep writing about it? Because we see ourselves in these people, these passengers, these crew. So those are coming very soon. Patreon members will get a discount and probably will get early access. And what else? What else? Probably a new shirt too. Maybe some stickers soon. And I'm thinking all of it available and plenty of time for holiday shopping and shipping. That's really exciting. I've been building towards that for almost a year for the mugs. Sometimes I'm a little shy to put things out there, but I'm excited to be working with these artists, and that makes it even more invigorating of a process. So look for those. And in the meantime, last thing, and I always say it, but it really does help, if you are able to throw a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, it helps the visibility of the podcast. The podcast is growing and it's sort of a cycle, right? It's, the more it grows, the more those reviews and ratings help. So thank you so much. All right. So let's jump in. I know that no one likes too much shop talk or housekeeping or any of that stuff so much at the beginning of an episode. So let's leave it behind. So I am a crazy Leo fanatic, self-identifying. And one of the things I did in the crazy Leo fanatic category over the last few weeks is I ordered a copy of British Vogue, where he and Lily Gladstone, the lead actress of Killers of the Flower Moon, are on the cover looking stunning. Wasn't available to buy locally for me. I had to order it. And then the other thing going on is that there is, as probably most of you know, an actor strike going on. SAG-AFTRA is still on strike. And so no actors can promote their movies unless they're given special waivers. I don't think Killers of the Flower Moon was given a waiver in the United States because none of the actors have been doing any press. Normally, Leo is not big on press to begin with, which I don't blame him because it's turned into a media, like pop culture media and film related media, interviews, promos, that sort of thing, is turned into a chaotic mess that is way too tangled up with social media, in my opinion, but that's a conversation for another day. So he's not big on that stuff, but usually when one of his movies comes out, we at least get a few segments here and there with him, which I always look forward to, and I'm sad to miss this time. So none of that. And Lily Gladstone has been on the SAG picket line and not promoting the movie, and I think that's it's amazing, and I applaud her. But Martin Scorsese has been out on the promo campaign trail, and he's the greatest living filmmaker, in my opinion. So it's been cool to hear from him. Anyway, so I ordered this magazine because it's one of the only true promos for the movie with Leo, except for their appearance at Cannes earlier in the year at the Cannes Film Festival. And I wanted to share a couple of things from this interview. So Lily Gladstone is a Native American actor. She was in the film Certain Women in 2016, directed by Kelly Reichardt, who is one of the great female directors of our time. If you've never seen any of her movies, highly recommend Certain Women, Meek's Cut Off, First Cow. They're quiet movies. They're quiet, thoughtful, independent films. Definitely worth checking out. So I'd seen her in that, and she was incredible in that. I think she also is on Reservation Dogs, which my husband and I are going to watch soon, and we're kind of mad at ourselves that we haven't watched. We've heard it's amazing. So she grew up on a Native American reservation. The article is partly about her relationship to this troubling history, portraying an Osage Indian. She is not Osage. Her family comes from a different group of Native Americans. And that in itself is a whole discussion, and I won't go into any of that today in detail because it's an entire historiography you would have to sit down and take notes on. I sometimes get things mixed up. But Native American tribes are a vast ocean of different cultures, languages. There are groups that are night and day from others. Tribes are so different in their culture, in their speech, in their histories. One of the great problems in how we write American history, especially for textbooks, especially when we try to sum things up, is we group Native Americans as, we say they are one thing. This is one group. Oh, we need to teach them Native American history. We do, but there's all sorts of Native American histories to teach, and tribes differ by geography, again, sometimes just by culture and practices and rituals. And so it's not a homogenous group. It's the furthest thing from it, is probably the best thing to say. So the article is her and Leo hanging out with the author. They're sort of just talking about how they came to these parts, what it means to release Killers of the Flower Moon in today's moment in history. And I will say, as a Leo fan, it was really amazing to hear the description of him eating a quote unquote doughy cookie during the interview. Makes me love him more. Sounds good. But it's, you know, for a short Vogue article, it actually was pretty hard hitting in terms of sharing some, as hard hitting as a Vogue article could be, let's clarify, and sort of explaining some of the history that this book and this movie unravels. And here's a quote from Leo from that article. Quote, he's talking about the Reign of Terror, the death of Osage Indians in Oklahoma, early 20th century. He says, quote, it's a completely forgotten part of American history and an opened wound that still festers. Lily, in the article, is very clear that this movie by Martin Scorsese that she and Leo are in is not a Western. It may look like it. There's guns, there's violence, there's the wide open landscape of the American West, but it's not a Western. It's a tragedy. It's an American tragedy. These deaths were murders. These were murders of American Indians by their white neighbors, their friends, people that they trusted. And in the case of the Burkhart family that's featured in the book and the movie, a collusion to murder by a spouse. I'll give a little background on the story and the making of the movie before I really unpack any sort of review. And I know it's a little bit all over the place. I really recommend reading the book and seeing the movie. I can't stress enough that a podcast is never going to give you the detail and the nuance on this that you need to fully understand it. So I definitely recommend reading David Grand's Killers of the Flower Moon and also seeing this movie. So Martin Scorsese worked with the Osage tribe that still survives today to construct the script. And in David Grand's book version of this American history, he focuses on a family. Lily Gladstone plays Molly, who's a real woman, and everyone I'm talking about was real. This is all nonfiction. This is all history. And her family was at the center of these murders because her mother died and all three of her sisters died over the course of just a few years. And she was married to a man named Ernest Burkhart, who Leo plays in the film. And Ernest Burkhart was the nephew of a man named William Hale, who was white. He and Ernest are white. And he was a cattleman, cattle rancher, with a lot of money and power in this area of Oklahoma, and had become to many of the Osage this benefactor. He built schools, he built hospitals, he built dance studios, and he very openly and in a very showy way built this narrative of himself as this great friend of the Osage who had been through so much. The Osage had been moved from territory to territory by white Americans, by the federal government. They had been relocated and had finally, of their own volition, chosen to end up in this area of Oklahoma that had really rocky soil and not fertile at all, because the tribe said, hey, maybe if we stay here, the government will stop moving us because they don't want anything from this land. If they don't want anything from the land, there are no resources here, because we know resources mean blood, then maybe we can finally be left alone and we'll stay here. There was oil underneath that land. Nobody knew it at the time. This is in the very late 1800s. But the tribe was very, very, this is crucial, very brilliant to make sure that the rights they had to the land, and they purchased this land where Osage country was, they purchased it, and they made sure that part of that purchase was the head rights, was the rights to minerals, rights to anything underground, anything subterranean, oil, minerals. Those resources also belonged to them because they bought the land. And that was a genius move, because then oil is discovered and all of the white people who thought, we've pushed these Native Americans to this desolate part of the American West that we don't want anything to do with, suddenly, guess what? They want everything to do with it, because the group of Osage Native Americans that live in this part of Oklahoma become the wealthiest people in the world per capita. Guess what? And I'll say it. Guess what white people traditionally do not like? They don't like historically people of color, people that aren't them, having money and having power. So they were uncomfortable with it. And guess what? They wanted the money and the power. So what ends up happening is white people infiltrate these Osage towns, and many of them play the part of employee or friend or husband in the case of Ernest Burkhardt, who marries Molly. What's going on under the surface is this evil plot, this system of murder, this system of violence, this culture of violence to kill many of them for their head rights, for their rights to this very lucrative oil business. This is not a story that you get in your American history class here in the US, like I said. In the middle of the 20th century, I think that because of the popularity of FBI stories and the history of the FBI, some people knew about it. My dad told me, my dad is 80, my dad told me he remembers newsreels about it, seeing things about it, vaguely remembers hearing these stories. But even in Oklahoma, I was reading an article about this the other day, even in Oklahoma, they do not teach these murders, which are known within the Native American culture as the Reign of Terror. And there are families where the grandchildren of the people that were killed are still very much alive and active and in our communities, in our world. That is how close this history is to us, just like I talk about all the time with Titanic. So Scorsese worked to adapt Killers of the Flower Moon into a film. He apparently was very moved in the 1970s and 1980s when he visited reservations in the United States and wanted to start telling Native American stories, but knew he would need to find the exact right material to adapt. And he said he finally found that in David Grand's Killers of the Flower Moon, which came out in 2017. Now, Scorsese very importantly vowed, and he did, to work with Osage members, living members of the tribe, to make sure that the script represented their story properly. There was an early version of the script, apparently, that focused more on what David Grand had done in the second part of the book, which was use the history of the early FBI run by J. Edgar Hoover, who, coincidentally, Leo has played in a film before. Not my favorite Leo movie, but that's a story for another day, J. Edgar. But Grand more focuses on the story of the early FBI using this agent that worked the case named Tom White, who was a former Texas Ranger, grew up in Austin in the early days of Austin. His dad was the jailer, was the sheriff. He was sort of an early Western lawman who had then started working for the FBI and was part of this crew of undercover men that went in to try to solve these Osage murders. So more of a whodunit, the book is. A little bit more of a introduce characters, not revealing things all at once. As the reader, you sort of have to unpack what's going on. And there's this huge focus on the FBI towards the end and Tom White. And the original script for this film apparently had that air about it. I joked with my husband the other day. I said, I bet I would put money on the fact, or a bunch of doughy cookies on the fact. I love it. That probably the first script was almost like an Ocean's 11 style Tom White, who's played by Jesse Plemons in the film, but it's a much smaller role than in the book, assembling his crew, right? He's got the undercover Native American who is going to sort of infiltrate the families in the area, undercover insurance salesman who, and this is all real, again, everything I'm talking about actually happened, who works as an insurance salesman and sells insurance to Hale. This crew of undercover people that go into Pawhuska, some of these Gray Horse, these Native American towns in the areas around it in Oklahoma. And I bet that's what the first, you know, pass of the script looked like, but they took it to the Osage elders, to the tribe. And also apparently Leo spoke out at this point and said he didn't feel comfortable with the script because it read as that, as almost like a white savior narrative. And now to be clear, David Grand's book does not read that way. I think just the way that you can tell a story in writing versus how you can tell it on screen are vastly different, which is why I will never write a screenplay and never produce a film. I know that about myself. So David Grand's book does not read like that. David Grand's book is a masterpiece of many different viewpoints. And we'll talk about it here at the end, but there's actually a few chapters where he does a lot of extra research with other families in the area, gets to know current members of the tribe, and goes the extra mile to tell stories of Osage that aren't in the main part of this story. And so a script rewrite cast Leo not as Tom White, who I think he was originally intended to play, but instead as Ernest Burkhart, who is married to Molly Burkhart, who under the orders of his uncle, William Hale, infiltrates Molly's Osage family and is very much a part of the intricate and horrid plan to eradicate essentially her entire family. I will say one part that is not included in the movie that's so poignant in the book is that at the end of the book, Gran reveals that through a series of interviews with some of the Burkhart descendants, he actually believes, and there's no way to know for sure, the parties involved are deceased, Ernest is now deceased, but that the family has some amount of proof that when Rita, one of Molly's sisters, died in an explosion with her husband, Bill Smith, that Molly and Ernest and Molly's children, young children at the time, were supposed to be in the house as well. So Ernest Burkhart potentially was ready and willing to kill off his entire family for money. So this is the scenario that the actors head into filming. And this movie was filmed several years ago. Scorsese is a methodical filmmaker, methodical editor. His editor is Thelma Schoonmaker, a woman who has worked with him for years and is phenomenal. Best in the business, but they are very methodical. And so it took a long time from shooting to screen to walk into my local Cinemark to see it. But these were the circumstances. And Lily Gladstone was cast. Lily Gladstone has a background on one side of her family, fully Native American, on the other. And this is where her last name comes from. She's actually descended from directly from British colonizers that lived in the West. Gosh, what state was it? I don't have the magazine in front of me. I believe it might have been the Pacific Northwest, but I will put that in the show notes. And so her own life is this marriage of the kind of chaotic history of the United States and colonization and a history of violence with this beautiful Native American culture and heritage that has survived. And Lily Gladstone, I encourage you to look up interviews with her and follow her on Instagram. She's such a beautiful and refreshing voice for Hollywood. I really hope that she wins the Oscar this year. I have a feeling that she might. So they enter into this filming process. They talk about this in the Vogue article, Leo and Lily do, that they are living this history as they're living in Oklahoma. You know, Leo especially, Lily less so. She has traditionally been more of a working class actor still, but they are unaccustomed to the often destitute conditions that exist in rural modern Oklahoma now that are a direct product of resource stripping and of poverty and oppression that is a direct result of all of the processes that go on in this book and this film. We're still living with them today, reverberating today, racism, prejudice, poverty that results from that, from the unequal distribution of opportunity. And so Leo talks about this. He actually stayed in Tulsa, Oklahoma for the filming, which was pretty close by, and commuted in. But he was honest. He said, I couldn't live out in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, in these conditions. And I think he sort of self-actualized in admitting that he needed the comforts of home while filming. And Lily Gladstone talks a little bit about this as well. but they were also in Tulsa for the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa race riots, which was a massacre by white supremacists attacking what was then called Black Wall Street. So talk about a thematic tie-in. Both situations, Tulsa race riots and the Osage murders, situations where non-whites gather money and power, and whites are not okay with that and act out violently. Blood, 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 and death. Killing children, killing men, women. Unfortunately, very thematically tied in. And then Leo makes a good point to stretch that theme over to things that are happening in Indonesia, the Amazon, Standing Rock, all of these current causes that he actually gives a lot of money to and pays a lot of attention to, which I applaud him for, where resources, global resources, are being stripped from indigenous peoples, from natives, or indigenous peoples and natives are watching as these are stripped, as blood is being spilled for them. And Leo points this out directly in this article, and it's not only him that's had this thought, historians, journalists have for years, that where there are resources, there is blood. And this book and this film, so grotesquely and beautifully, if those things can be married together, which I think they have to be in American history, and heartbreakingly show how that is definitely the case. So the filming of this was epic, and the movie is epic. It is astonishing. It is Scorsese at his best. I am more a student of recent Scorsese. Unshockingly, my favorite Scorsese of all time is Wolf of Wall Street. Second favorite is The Departed. This should come as no shock to anyone, as Leo is in both of those films. Obviously, Leo and Scorsese have had a partnership going since Kings of New York all the way back in 2002. And I think that they're going at it again. They're doing another David Gran adaptation, if news reports are to be believed, of David Gran's new book, The Wager, which is about a shipwreck in the 1700s. So we may get Leo back in the ocean, but in a very, very different way from Titanic. So all that to say, I am a student and a fan of later Scorsese, but I was raised on some early Scorsese as well. I was raised by a complete cinephile. And I have to say, it's probably in his top five of all time, if not his top three. It is sweeping epic that is 3.5 hours long, but it does not feel that way. Obviously, I've already spoiled a few things about the story. I think when it's history, when it's nonfiction, spoilers are less important. It's more important to just talk about it. But I will point out a couple of things from the film that I liked particularly. And so if you haven't seen the film yet, maybe pause here, maybe skip this and go see it. One thing that struck me as gorgeous was his use of Native American symbology. Images, things that in the Osage culture mean something. And even as a white filmmaker, he's incorporating them and using them in this great detail in scenes. There are two scenes where characters are near death and they see an owl appear out of nowhere. And it's this vibrant, and I believe it's partly CGI, but it's CGI done well. But it's this owl appearing against a sparse room of just wood planking and whitewashed walls. And it in those moments, even as a white viewer, who I sometimes feel like I'm looking in on stories of people of color and worry, what can I do? How much can I do? I think the thing I can do is read and consume and be aware and educate myself so that I can be an ally. But as a white viewer, to see that, it is such an immersive experience of at least attempting to understand what some of the meanings and symbols in Native American culture are, that this owl is seen, according to Native American lore, according to Osage lore, in the hours before your death. What a powerful image, what a powerful monument to that entire culture. And I will tell you, I know my voice is very elevated while I'm recording this episode, and I think I'm sounding kind of frenetic, but it's because all of this means so much to me because I have learned so much. Even as a historian, I spent so many years in undergrad and graduate school studying American history and never was told this story. So I thought that was really powerful. There's also a scene where one of the characters does die and the Native American elders appear from beyond the grave to take her over to the light, to take her to the afterlife. And it's a great moment in film. I think what this movie does is finally forefront Native American stories in the history of the American West. You think about all the Westerns. Westerns have been a thing for over 100 years. And there's this point in the mid-20th century where Westerns are the most profitable part of Hollywood. This is not a Western. This is a tragedy. But it does have some of that predictable imagery of a Western. And it turns it on its head and forefronts Native Americans. And Scorsese also gives long scenes to Native American characters where they are allowed to express what their viewpoint is. The camera is on them. They almost break the fourth wall. No one's ever done that before. And, you know, Lily Gladstone talks about this in several interviews I've read from her, including the Vogue one. Yes, arguably an Osage filmmaker is the person that should have made this movie. But for right now, who is Apple TV going to give $200+ million to make this movie? Unfortunately, not a Native American filmmaker, but Scorsese, they would. And he has done what he can to do justice to the story. And I truly believe that he did. The imagery is astounding. The cinematography is astounding. The music, actually composed by Robbie Robertson, astounding. Direction is astounding. The acting is astounding, all the way down to the character actors that pop up playing some of these really dumb henchmen that are just trying to bilk Native Americans for everything that they possibly can. And I think what Scorsese has done, and please tell me if you think I'm wrong, if you interpreted it differently, by forefronting Ernest, and Leo just is despicable in this role. He's got fake teeth that are dirty. His posture, his stance, the way he talks, he sort of puts his bottom lip up a little bit. He looks kind of disgusting. Like, he looks a little bit like, I don't want to be in a room with this person. Although still maintaining a little bit of the sort of rugged handsomeness, which is part of the reason Molly falls for him. But he's quite despicable looking. And he's quite dumb. And he runs with this group of quite dumb white henchmen, all in their like 20s, 30s, 40s. And I think Scorsese wanted to forefront them in the story as well, to show that the real danger at that time, and unfortunately the real danger in society still, is the henchmen, you know, is the people in the middle or even at the bottom that will do the bidding of people in power or be told, well, you know, better do this. There's a threat here. We need this money. And you have to commit these violent acts in order to be a part of this system of and culture of violence so that the white people in the community can come out on top. That system is sometimes almost invisible because there are so many components of them. And that is still going on today, that unfortunately some of the most dangerous people in our society are the people that are just in the middle of this larger system of violence because they are being fed ideas and notions. And the other component here is the film does such a good job of showing another sad fact, which is that if you are a non-white person for most of American history, and arguably still today, unfortunately, as well, that crimes against you are not prosecuted in the same way. It is a movie that is arriving at the right moment, just as the book did in 2017, to open our eyes. And I probably will see it at least one more time in theaters. I urge you, I beg you to go see it. Many of you may know from following on Instagram or talking with me on the Patreon live stream events over the past year that one of my big research interests right now is the history of American slavery. And if you had asked me a year ago if that mixed with the history of Titanic in any real thematic way in terms of my writing and projects upcoming, I would have said, I wish, but I don't know necessarily, but I am here to tell you. They do. A lot of the passengers that we study on Titanic, and I highlighted this in the Strauss episode a few weeks ago, their lives, their livelihoods are direct products of a system of racial oppression in this country that is this huge part of American history that we don't talk about it enough. And I think the history of Native Americans is very similar. So I am, you know, shout out to Angela, who is a longtime listener of the show, Patreon supporter, Patreon VIP, honestly, top listener award. She's amazing and so supportive. And she and I are friends now. She lives in Texas. Shout out Angela, because I noticed on her Instagram the other day, she was posting about it being Scorpio season. She's a Scorpio too. So shout out fellow Scorpios. My birthday's in a couple of weeks. I feel like it is. I've never really believed very strongly in astrology or all of that, but there is an energy brewing around what I'm working on and a lot of the themes I'm working on sort of melding and meshing together. I wanted to share a book that I'm reading right now. It's called Slaves in the Family. It's by Edward Ball. And it's an older book. I mean, I hate to say that the late 90s was a long time ago, but unfortunately, I guess I'm at the point where I have to admit that the late 90s were a long time ago. But he comes from a southern plantation family, a rice family in South Carolina. And he decides, I think he's like in his 30s when he decides this. He's a journalist. He decides, you know, screw this. No one in my family has talked about the slaves that we owned in any detail. There's people in my family that are still, you know, Old South, celebrate the Confederacy. That's bullshit. I'm not doing this anymore. And he goes on a research quest to find descendants of the slaves that were in the Ball family. I don't know how much press this book got in the late 90s when it came out. I hope a good amount, but it's all about reckoning and coming to terms, but also reaching out to try to, in some even small, tiny way, fix the mistakes of your ancestors. And it's about blood and sweat and tears. And and it's a memoir. It's really well done as a memoir. And it's really been moving me. It's a very long book. It's a tome. I highly recommend it. I also really recommend a book called A Shot in the Moonlight. It's called How a Freed Slave and a Confederate Soldier Fought for Justice in the Jim Crow South. It is by Ben Montgomery. I read this a couple of months ago, and just in the category of casting Southern history and Black history, forefronting Black history, it just is astounding as well. That's another big recommendation, and that's more recent. And I have been going all the way back to, I think I mentioned it the other week, like Alan Taylor, he's a historian, his like huge tomes on the American colonies and the origins of slavery in the colonies. Of course, 1619 Project is really important. There's so many books that have just been like absorbing in my bones and my blood and my body lately. And I am working on some projects that will hopefully do justice to everything that I'm reading and researching. But as a white Southerner, it's, you know, it's so crazy. I spent 6 years in graduate school, and before that, 4 years in undergrad, and before that, very actively studying history in high school as well, studying all of these things, Native American history, Black history, Southern history, and just never has been so clear to me and so disturbing. So I know you signed up for Titanic, but there are just going to be these episodes that are about other things and so much more. And I think we'll always end up back at Titanic, but I thank you for allowing me to use this platform and this feed to talk about some really crucial moments in American history. And you know, the Osage murders were happening in the late 19-teens, early 1920s, not long after Titanic. And it's relevant. It's very relevant to the era. Thank you for listening. I love Leo. and the movies that he makes. And I thank him once again for bringing me to a really important and crucial story. He continues to do that. He always does that. And for some crazy reason, he ever happens upon this episode or anything that I do, just to thank you. You know, it just never ceases to amaze me. And in the meantime, read the book, see the movie. I was originally going to talk a lot more about other Leo movies. I never mind watching Leo movies. So the rewatches I've been doing over the past few months, I've just been, you know, for fun as well. But maybe I'll get everything together for another true retrospective at some point. In the meantime, I do know the sound may have not been peak sound for this episode. I am finally in my office/studio. Months after moving, I'm finally recording in the right room. I'm just still working on the noise and buffering, and so I know it may be a little echoey, and I apologize about that. Lot to come soon. Titanic Blood and Steel will be coming, not as soon as I had hoped, but it's coming. I just want to really do good by it and make sure I watch every minute. Some research I'm doing on Second Class Family is coming soon. An interview with Veronica Hinke for her new Titanic cookbook. I've already recorded that interview. I'm going to save it for a little bit closer to the holidays, but she graciously came on for the third time, and she's absolutely just fantastic. And speaking with her is always so fun and very food centric. And I love like peeking into that world and just getting to talk about food and drink. It's so fun. So look for that. I think that's about it in terms of announcements. Look for the mug stuff soon. I believe that's it. I won't ramble. You guys are the best. Rate, review. Am I hypnotizing you? Okay. Bye. Bye, guys.